And we're live on the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. Frank, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing really, really good. We got a special guest here today that I'm excited about. Got to see him speak in New York City at Strip Mall Guys event. Tyron McDaniel. How you doing, Tyron?
Man, it's a pleasure to be here. And thanks for having me on, guys. Excited. Strip Mall event, that was a pretty dope event, right?
Yeah, Soho House. I didn't get to go to the after party. I had to get back for my kids. But Soho House, trendy spot in New York. We had a couple of good speakers. It was good. It was good.
Was that your first time at a Soho House?
Do I lose points? Like, do I lose cool points? No, if
hey,
I say yes?
I'm a first timer, bro. So, hey, if you lose, was. I lose. So, we're kindred spirits in that.
I actually had a friend in high school that like founded it. But like the second Whoa. She got cool, I think I DM'd her like, hey, really great. Congratulations. And she just ignored me. So my
okay.
ticket in, gotcha. I never was able to cash it. So.
Very good. All right. So we got hooked up through Twitter. Your Twitter bio says, I develop, design, and build attainable and affordable housing in inner city urban neighborhoods. What's that mean, Tyron? And what is your business plan, man?
So, you know, said differently in layman's term, man, I build and develop houses in the hood, you know, to just, you know, and which I was there in New York at the event that Frank's talking about. And it's so funny. A guy asked me, he's like, why would you do real estate in the hood? I said, well, that's where I'm from. You know, if I grew up in, you know, the ritzy area town, I'd probably do ritzy deals. But that just for what some weird reason that doesn't excite me as a kid. You know, I remember the places that we lived in, and it's kind of funny how serendipitous life can be. But as a kid in elementary school and middle school, I would look at our house, you know, when we were staying in an apartment, then my mom went through the process of buying a home. And I said, man, you know what? It would be dope if I could get to a position in life to where I could provide housing for families like mine, but I'm gonna do it nicer. You know what I mean? Because even as a kid, I recognized in affordable housing that the standards were fairly low. You know what I mean? Like what the service providers were providing to that market, it was housing. And so a win is a win. So, you know, hey, having a house is better than not having one. But I never forget the feeling of thinking, man, you know what? I could do this a little bit better. And so our mission is to reshape the face of inner city Houston one home at a time. And so that's really what my mission is. And my business plan is just that. You know, we buy in inner city communities that generally are the hood, that are in some phase of being redeveloped and or gentrified. And so me, I like to be a trailblazer and be a part of creating an environment in these communities where people want to either stay there and or move into those areas.
How do you navigate the world of you're a capitalist, but most people talking like you seem to come from the nonprofit world. How do you think about those two different hats? Sure. I know that's a big question and it's probably what we're going to talk a lot about. Right. But it's just surprising because you don't hear many people saying like, hey, this is my for-profit business plan, but it's also hopefully going to make the world a better place too.
Most certainly. Well, you know, fundamentally, there's some, I read it somewhere at some point in time or picked it up, but there's a term I came across called compassionate capitalism. Another way of saying it is I genuinely believe you can do good by doing good. And so for me, when I think of nonprofits, I think of bureaucracy, red tape, long lines, hurry up and wait, let me beg you for some money, blah, 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 blah. Early on in my building development career, I have a fairly short attention span. So I knew that anything that required me going through government subsidies, networking with politics, city officials and things of that nature wasn't going to be my forte. And then I ain't had a background or the pedigree for it, you know. So for me, it was about, you know, I just felt like there's enough margin in here to provide a quality house and not necessarily, you know, be top dollar. And so that was my premise, you know, is I'm gonna figure out a way to squeeze a few, you know, a little margin out of this thing. And so it hasn't been an easy journey. But it was one that was definitely worthwhile and it was something I was committed to. And for me, I've never based my life goals around money. I'm not a money motivated person. I understand that I need money to coexist. I have a wife, family, you know, people I have to support. But, you know, fundamentally, I felt like, you know, I used to drive trucks for a living. So if I could make a living driving a truck, how can I not make a living, you know, building and flipping in or renovating houses? So I think a large part of that had to do with my point of reference. If I came to this with some, you know, a master's and all these different degrees, I was making $200,000-$300,000, you know, doing X, Y, Z. And then I came to this, my point of reference would have been a little bit different. But coming from a person who was making at one point in my life, 25, 30, 35 grand a year, I can carve out a living building and flipping houses 100%.
Right. And you, and I think you offer a little bit more of a differentiated product too, because don't you have your hands pretty heavy into design for this affordable housing too? Like, take us through that part of your business.
Sure.
What that looks like.
So 100%. So we do have a design firm called Urban Vintage Designs and Development, where we design and consult with home builders and developers to help them design their products for their housing. And really it stemmed from, again, wanting to provide, you know, I have a line of products that we start homes, we start design that I call affordable luxury. And the premise was, you know, let me give you one or two things in your house that it may cost me a little bit more, but it's, again, it's not going to kill the margins, if you will. So to make it tangible, you know, rather than put most people are doing shaker cabinets, but if it's an affordable house, they're going to do 36 inches. We're going to do at least 42 inch cabinets. Real, real subtle. So that's an extra $400 or $500 per kitchen. But it makes a tremendous impact. Like, it's hands down, it's emphatic. Most guys do an affordable house, they're going to do a real basic subway tile and a backsplash. We'll do that same subway. However, we're going to do it in a chevron pattern or herringbone pattern. And right above the stove, we're going to put an accent tile. So that accent tile cost us $10 a square foot. We're going to put 2 feet of tile back there. So that's an additional $20 plus the border around it. So we're in this thing, an extra $50 in the backsplash. So between the cabinets and the backsplash, we spent an extra, let's just call it $600. However, what I, you know, the when that man or woman opens that door, and we had this design concept called line of sight. So I generally like to design my kitchens where when you open that door, you're going to see what I call the CCT, color, character, and texture. So when you open that door and you see those things, yes, it's affordable, but it doesn't. You don't think, oh, this is an affordable house. You think, man, this is really cool. Man, this really looks nice. And so that's just a tenet that I began to put through all our properties. And the reason why I came up with a design firm, I didn't go to college for architecture. I learned everything I know from a design perspective by, you know, taking my thoughts and putting it into a house. This worked, that didn't work. And I just kept refining it. And what I found myself doing is, I would sketch out on a pad, you know, like this. Well, you can't see that. I'd sketch out on a pad, you know, what I wanted. Then I'd take it to an architect to put into a set of plans. And so I'm thinking to myself, I'm the one designing this. All he's doing is taking my thoughts and putting it into CAD so that I can submit it for permits. Why am I paying him and he's not doing any of the thinking? So I said, okay, great. Let me set up my own company. I'll hire two architects to be on staff. And now somebody, you know, they can help me just manifest my dreams versus paying a fee for somebody. It'd be one thing if I took them to the house and they designed it. It was another thing. I walk through the house, look at it, see it's a piece of crap, it's functionally obsolete, and then I figure out what needs to go there. And the other part of it was, if I made a bad decision on design, I took the financial responsibility of that. For the architect was long gone. He got his check. It didn't matter if the house sold for $30,000 less. He got paid already. So I said, if I'm financially responsible, why not really be responsible for the entire thing? And so that was, you know, how it came out. It basically became a cost-cutting measure. I could vertically integrate this into our business model versus it being some outside. And then it gives me total autonomy and control over the end product.
I think that's a really big deal in the affordable housing space, because most people who start out buying a house at a time in the affordable housing arena, which John and I were part of that, is like, do direct seller marketing, find something at distress, buy it really cheap, you fix it up exactly right, like you said before, with like very little design thought, repeat the process 20 times and then you got a business, right? So when did you know you were going to end up being a designer? Like, how did you, if everyone starts out there, or a lot of people start out there, how did you end up, like, when did you realize, like, I'm into design? Like, when did you know that?
Well, again, man, it's so funny. So a lot of times in life, you can learn so much about your future by looking at your past. And so I recall being in middle school and taking drafting. And I recall, you know, being introduced to Frank Lloyd Wright early on in my, you know, around middle school, eighth, ninth grade, and reading his books. Now, I'm just a kid growing up in Fifth Ward. If you ever heard the Ghetto Boys, that's where Ghetto Boys, Willie D, Bushwick Bill, they from Fifth Ward in Houston, Texas, right east of downtown. So, you know, I was just a kid from the hood, but I love to read. I always love to read. And so I recall being exposed to Frank Lloyd Wright and studying his stuff. So fast forward and bring that into now I'm out here messing with houses. In my first, first time I built a house was a fairly large development that didn't go as planned. And one of the biggest lessons that came out of it not going as planned was, you know, this was supposed to be a 14 home development. And so I had two houses of the 14 that I was building at the time. Now I only built two of the 14 that should have gotten built. Actually, it was 12, excuse me, of the 12 houses because I had to sell the project and get out of the deal because for some other reasons. But what I figured out was I was more of a builder than a developer. See, I liked spending time with the cabinet guys and going over what kind of trim we were going to do, what kind of profile of the cabinets. Like I liked all the subtle nuances and the design stuff. Sitting in the office, having conversations with guys like yourself about, you know, what my IRR is going to be and, you know, what the sales price per square footage was going to be and really managing the capital raising and the you know, all the administrative tasks that are associated being a developer didn't interest me. And so my biggest takeaway from my first building project was I love the minutiae of design and the nuances of the house. And so that's with that being in the back of my head, as I kept, you know, kind of growing my business, I figured out, you know what, you really do have something for design. So yes, you can build, yes, you can develop, but you really have an eye for design. And then I started having people, once I figured out my niche and we started producing product, I'd have people that come to me and say, hey, you know, why'd you do this or how or why? And so I was like, or would you do it for me? And so out of that became, you know what, not only can I vertically integrate this into my business and then just having a business, you're always looking for ways to add to the bottom line. So I was like, well, if I design a couple of projects here and there, that becomes a revenue stream to cover the overhead associated with me designing for my own products. And so, yeah, it was just very serendipitous. I wish I could tell you that, you know, at my genesis, I said, okay, this is what I'm going to build. But, you know, it's just one of those things as you matriculate, you learn, you take specialized knowledge from here, you add it to this, you take a concept from here, there, and you put it together and you create, you know, what I call a design gumbo, if you will. So it's all these mixtures of things that you put together and it becomes something.
Very good. But so if that's what came naturally, maybe the follow-on question then is how have you grown into a CEO role that is strategic? And I imagine at some point does have to talk IRR or returns when you're getting debt on that. How have you balanced those two hats?
Balance is an illusion, I would say. You know what I mean? I don't know. I can't tell you that I perfected it. But, you know, there are just certain things that you got to do, right? So if you're running a company, you know, you have to have capital. 100%. So there's certain things that are born out of necessity. So it's like, okay, we want to do X, Y, Z. We're going to need this amount of capital to do that. It doesn't matter how beautiful it looks. And so it becomes, it's less about balance and more about priorities. You know, one, capital is important. So there's to me, the capital supersedes the design. You know what I mean? So the CEO role has to be at the forefront. Because if I perform my CEO duties properly, it then affords me the time to be able to invest in what I love more than being a CEO, which is the design part and so on and so forth. So to me, I look at it as a means to an end. I have to perform certain tasks so that I can get around to what I really like, if that makes sense.
Very good. And then what does your team look like? What does your portfolio look like at this point?
Sure. So what our team, so, you know, you have myself and my wife. My wife's a real estate broker, has been in real estate now for over 20 years. And so she and I are the figureheads. We have, you know, a few virtual assistants that help us from an operational perspective. Everything outside of that is more or less kind of contractors and or 1099 based people that are project oriented. So we try to run a really lean operation from a perspective of what it takes to run our companies per se. Our portfolio right now consists of But right now we have probably, here, I got a list here.
That means a lot.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, well, it's third stuff in transition right now. Yeah. So we have that we're going to keep and retain. We have 30 units that we're going to keep and retain that are, you know, like rental units. I'm laughing because my wife is playing with me. So we had this thing whenever, when either one of us are doing a call, we'll do something to distract the other person. So she's doing well,
at least you didn't say your wife was vertically integrated before. I thought you were about to say it. I was like, don't do that.
Nah. So yeah. So the part of our portfolio that is static right now is roughly 30 units. Outside of that, we have about 10 projects that total probably about $6 million or so that are either in some stage of development. So it's a new construction project where we've acquired land, we're going through the development and permitting process that will either be built to rent or for sale. And the reason why that's fluid is it's depending on when we deliver them to the market, and what the market looks like will dictate whether they stay on our books or if we offload them. Probably have about 5 houses right now that are, well, 4 that are for sale, one that will be for sale here pretty soon. We have probably right now about 6-7 we have about 7 units right now that we're renovating that should be completed and ready here sometime in the next 45 to 60 days.
Very cool. And
that's intense.
Yeah, that is
a lot of projects.
That's a lot of, yeah, especially because you're buying out your liabilities, but you do have a lot of accountability because you pretty much own the entire supply chain. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot for sure.
How's your deal flow right now? I think a lot of people are like, hey, man, I can't get anything to pencil. It's really hard with rates moving up and down as they are. How is the current environment affecting you down in Houston?
Honestly, man, right now we have a mantra around here. Say no. Just say no. Like the old DARE campaign, right? It's like, deal flow, the deals are there. Like in our market, the way we buy. So my buy box is this on the residential side of things that we do. So I buy a lot of old Ragley. I'm the old Ragley house guy in Houston. So if you have a house that you think is a teardown, I'll get that. If it's in inner city Houston, I get that call, generally speaking, or I get that DM. Hey, Tom, we got this. And so I'll buy any house in any condition if you sell it to me for land value. Because in my mind, that means I get the structure for free. Now, to the untrained or unexpert eye, they're saying, why would you buy this piece of crap house? You might as well tear it down and build new. What they don't understand is in a city like Houston, one, I'm going to spend 60 days in design, another 60 days in engineering, and then another 4 to 5 months in permitting. That's 9 months or so. Well, in 4 months, I could have taken that old Ragley house you think is a teardown and turned it into something that looks really, really nice. So I've saved myself 5 months plus the added cost of, you know, design, all those soft costs of design, engineering and whatnot. So that's one reason why. Or that's my buy box and how we buy. Now, we'll buy land, you know, and it's just the basics. If I can buy land at a discount of its market value in the areas that we like to play in, then I'll buy it. But that's why, that's a little bit about our buy box and how we buy. And yeah, deal flow has been great for us because one of the things I noticed, like me, I always like to identify what I call inefficiencies in a market. Okay. One of the inefficiencies I noticed in residential is most people come and, you know, it's kind of like an oil field industry. You know, they have, you know, downstream, upstream, so on and so forth. Most people like to be upstream in real estate. So they come in on a deal as an agent side, as a wholesaler side. So yeah, this bottleneck of all these deals, but there's not enough people that can take those deals and turn them into a product that can hit the marketplace. So one thing I recognize is if I get proficient at construction and redesign and remodeling, I'll forever have deal flow because I can take the worst house in the area and turn it into something that's functional that people will want to live in. So deal flow is never really an issue for me in residential real estate.
Yeah. There's a polarizing statement that's like, find a way to pay the higher price, right? And I'm not saying that that's what you do, but you could. you know?
No.
And if you can do that, like that's how you can actually
100%.
If you're the person there that needs to buy 60 cents in the dollar, you can only do that twice a year. That's
right.
What it is.
Well, you know, it's, I put it to you like this. So we're right now we're entering a space. I'm starting to ramp up a little bit more of our wholesaling side of what we do. So I would wholesale, like if I'm coaching or mentoring someone into that wants to do what I do, then I would actually find a deal and wholesale it to them and then kind of coach and guide them through it. And so now we're ramping up that where I'm offloading more deals to even people that I have, you know, just offloading deals 100%. But in directly acquiring our trans deals to do this, one of the things I tell the seller is fundamentally, I can pay you more than this guy, Frank, who's calling you trying to buy your property. And they're like, well, how can you do that? Because of what we're talking about now, because he's going to pay 15 to 20% more on his construction because he doesn't have a home building company. Whereas I can self-manage our project, do it for a little bit less than that, which affords you an opportunity to get a little bit higher purchase price. So there are certain scenarios where we introduce that in our negotiations that fundamentally we can and are willing to pay you more than probably 90% of the investors talking to you.
And then how do you think about exiting those deals? When Frank and I were doing it, we wanted to hold everything forever, but you have to flip some stuff to get cash flow. And then if right. flipping is costing too much and taking too long, you end up wholesaling. And before you know it, you know, it's easy to fall in love with that quick wholesale cash too. And you're not holding or flipping anything. So how do you guys think about those exits?
Well, so going back to one of my missions is, you know, because of the areas we play in, it's important that we have liquidation events. One, because we need capital. But two, our part of our mission is to get more people into these communities. So people like, you know, when I was coming up, me and all my buddies, everyone I knew, we were doing our darndest to get out of the neighborhood. So we wanted to get out of the hood. Then once we got out of the hood, we saw what was happening there. And so now it's like, oh, we got to get back. But a lot of us didn't want to go back because we couldn't afford it. Or, you know, in our mind, so in my neighborhood, you know, it's called Fifth Ward. Well, when they start introducing, now they call it East River. So when they changed the vernacular and the phraseology used to describe the area, you know that redevelopment is transpiring. So part of getting more people that were historically from these neighborhoods back into them means I have to sell off some of these properties to get these people back into these areas. So that's the first reason we sell, or that's the second reason we sell. The first reason is we need liquidation events. And then, you know, there's a part of me that loves the buy and hold business more so than any other aspect of real estate. And the older I get, the more value and the more appreciation I have for buying, holding, indefinitely, and never selling. And so I think there's a certain point you have to get to financially, or just a certain level of discipline you got to have to subscribe to that and stick to it. But for us, you know, that's why there's a, like when you ask, what does our portfolio look like there's a few components to it. So there's the part of our business where we're buying stuff that we don't ever plan on selling. And then there's the part of our business where, you know, this stuff will get either offloaded within the next 0 to 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, just depending on a couple of variables.
Very, very cool. That's awesome. It's because you make money and it still aligns with your vision, which is great. I wanted to pivot
100%.
I know we want to talk about this. The rant and the conversation on Twitter, which I know we're all a part of, is like, hey, the world's going to fall down. Everyone who bought a deal in the last 5 years is going to get washed away, just like it was in 2008 and 9. I know you were around and you've been doing this for a while. So
I don't know how, though. You don't look a day over about 25.
I know, you look younger.
You got a couple of gray hairs in your beard.
I'm far from the camera, so you can't see those grays. And I'm not one of those guys that die by it. So I'm staying intentionally far away from the camera.
Very good.
What similarities, what differences do you see? How should people tread water out here? What's your advice?
So my advice right now is to be what I call cautiously optimistic. Okay. About today's market. And allow me to digress for a second, because I think it's important to have context. You know, a lot of people talk about today or 10 years or, you know, the GFC, global financial crisis, with an isolated lens or perspective. And if you don't understand the context and some of the controlling or dominating factors that created that environment, then it's hard for you to kind of really get the tangible lessons you should get. So back during that time frame, 2008, 2009, I was a lender, which is how I started out in the industry of real estate. I started out on the finance side. So I was a mortgage broker. We did loans all over the country. When my wife and I bought our first home back in 2000, we used a no money down loan. So that meant that you didn't have to have a down payment. And not only did you not have to have a down payment, the lenders would allow you to finance or get up to 6% seller concession. So back in 2006, 2007, 2008, you know, we bought our house, $170,000 house, and literally came to closing with like $2,000. Okay. Because all of our other closing costs were wrapped into the loan because the house appraised for enough for us to buy for, I think we were buying it for like $175. We inflated the price to like $180 or so. And so that meant we brought, you know, the difference, which was about $2,000. When I first entered the mortgage business, you had to have at least a 640 credit score to get 100% loan. Then it went to 620. Then it went to 600. Then it went to 580. Then it went to 560. Then it went to 540. When it dropped below 580, now at that point, I've been in real estate a few years now. And I remember thinking to myself, man, who's lending 100% loan to a person with a 580, 560 credit score? Because, you know, this was during the subprime days. And so we did a lot of subprime loans. And so this, if you got a 5 anything credit score, that means you got some charge offs. You might have had a repossession several years ago. And then I'll never forget, the lender was a lender called MILA, M-I-L-A, Mortgage Investment Lenders of America, I think, or association. They were out of like Minnesota or something. I'll never forget. And they did they had a 520 credit score, 100% loan. And I remember thinking to myself, man, this can't end right. Something bad is going to happen. But see, this was my first time, so I didn't have a point of reference. But just in my little lack of knowledge having brain, I knew that that wasn't going to end well. Now, last point thing I want to tell you is we had what they call fog and mirror loans back then, which meant if you could put a mirror under your nose and create some condensation, you could literally get a loan. It's important for people to understand that, because I want to juxtapose that kind of lending environment with today. It's never been more difficult than it is today to get a loan since the inception of credit scores in the mid 80s. Today, back then, you could get 100% loan with a 520 credit score. Today, if you had a 520 credit score, you could put down 50%. There's still pretty much next to zero lenders that are going to do that deal. So think about it for a second. 2008, I could get a loan for 100% of the purchase price and basically come to closing with almost no money and buy a house. Today, I could put down 50% and still wouldn't get a house with that score. So what that says is the people who have a loan today are some of the most qualified borrowers to buy in modern history. Now, the market, it tanks. You lose your job. Okay, great. But you got a 4%, 3% interest rate. Oh, and by the way, if you got an FHA loan, they just came out and said, we'll take your 30-year loan and convert it through modification to a 40-year loan. So you already got an almost free interest rate. And now they're saying, we'll modify it if you get into trouble. And here's the other point. Even people that have bought in 2021 since COVID, right? 2022, oh, you paid $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 above list, but you still got $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in equity. So if all goes to hell in a handbasket here in the next year or so, these people have the ability to modify their loans and extend that loan out. And a lot of them still have equity. Unless you know, there's very few markets where the market has corrected to where these people don't have equity. So I say all of that to paint a picture and give context to the state of what the average borrower is financially in. So the average person with a mortgage right now has a credit score north of 680. So I say all that to say is I see it very difficult for us to have a market implosion because of that, number one. Then number two, we're still in a inventory constrained market, because what a lot of people don't realize, I just had this conversation on Facebook of all places. I had a doom and gloomer telling us the world is going to end, real estate's going to tank. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, I want you to research how many material suppliers went out of business and never came back since 2008, 2009. I want you to research the average age of licensed trades. What you're going to find is plumbers and electricians are north of 50 to 55 years old, and they're on their way out, not on their way in. And look at the attrition. How many people are retiring versus that are not entering the marketplace? So we have a labor constraint. And then the last part of that I shared with them is how many home builders and developers never re-entered the industry after 2008, 2009. So when you look at all of these factors, what you realize is people say that we have fabricated demand. No, it's not fabricated. The numbers are the numbers and they don't lie. We are undersupplying houses. And depending on whose statistics you read, we're short 6 to 8 million houses. And that's true. If you ever spend any time studying affordable housing, you'll see it. So that long 5-minute dissertation is why I don't believe that we're going to see an implosion in real estate. And one of the last things I'll say on this is what I don't think a lot of people realize is you can have an economic crash. An economic crash doesn't mean every sector of the economy crashes. It just means GDP goes down, employment goes up, unemployment goes up, and things of that nature. Inflation goes up, but there will still, just like, you know, during recessions and depressions, you know, your vices thrive. Beer sales, alcohol sales, you know, cigarette sales, they grow up. I think we could literally have an economic crash and real estate to a certain degree. There will be segments of real estate that are going to have that are crashed, and even residential is going to go down. But I just don't see a crash because we just don't have the abundance in inventory to create more supply than demand.
Yeah. And it's probably not going to come. It's 2/3 of the houses have people with 4% interest rates or less.
Right.
So like what, you know, if there's no forced selling, if unemployment doesn't get up to crazy numbers, then like,
right,
probably stuck with what we got. You know,
right. And even, let's say unemployment does go crazy. You're going to sell the house, right? But you've got equity. So it means you're going to get a chunk of capital. Now you still don't have a job, but that house does hit the market. But because there are people that still to this day hadn't been able to buy, guess what they're going to do? My son plays basketball. We just, one of the coaches was talking to us about buying. They tried buying a house 10 years ago, couldn't buy, didn't have the credit. Now they got the credit. And now the issue is they can't afford what they want. So they're just waiting. And there's millions of people like that around the country that are just waiting. And hopefully for them, there's some kind of relief that comes. But what I told them is I don't know how much, you know, it may go down $10,000, $12,000, but you know, what is that? A $15 difference in your
the floor mortgage? Is too healthy. The floor is healthy. Yeah,
exactly. I like that. The floor is too healthy. I got to write that down.
Oh, really? Wow. I didn't know I was that quotable. All right.
That's good.
No, I agree. I'm in Tampa. I think, you know, similar to a lot of the MSAs in Texas. I think Tampa and Texas, Florida, some of these stronger markets throughout the Southeast. I think even if, you know, from a macro perspective, the economy is going down, I think there's going to be strong markets that feel very, very little of it.
100%. And I mean, you know, I saw it during the global financial crisis. You know, one of the things that blew me away was, you know, I tell people during great times like now, I know a city like Houston does pretty good. During horrible economic times, because of the diversity of our economy, you know, we're spread out through, you know, about 12 very dynamic multi-billion-dollar industries right now. If you go back to the mid-80s when we had the oil bust, you know, Houston's economy was spread out between basically three industries. Now, you know, it's more like 12. And so during tough financial times, people move here because relatively speaking for a large MSA, we still are relatively expensive and the job market is absolutely insane.
Very good. So where do you go from here, right? Like you know, where do you want to go with your company? What are those goals for the next, you know, 10, 20 years as much as you want to?
Yeah. So pretty much what we're really doing right now is kind of we're kind of adjusting our sales, if you will, to for the next 10 years or so. And so for years, I've always stayed in, you know, I built a pretty comfortable existence, if you will. And, you know, it wasn't too big, wasn't too small. It was just kind of just in this little space. But one of the things I've loved and a part of my vision that I always knew I'd ultimately get to is really impacting and doing projects in other markets. And so through our design and development firm, we're starting to do a lot of design and consulting for affordable housing projects in other markets. So I'm really excited to grow that portion of our business. And we're starting to do bigger projects. You know, I like doing, you know, one house at a time or two or three houses on one lot, things of that nature, building, you know, three or four new construction projects. We have a 14 unit under development right now project. I've kind of started to lean into buying apartment complexes and whatnot. So we have two LOIs right now out on a collection of units. That's a 30 unit project, another unit that's an 18 unit project near the Astrodome. So we're starting to kind of lean into some commercial. I have a son who's a junior in high school right now. And so I'm really kind of setting things up. He's always loved the buy and hold. He's invested, you know, his college fund is invested in different projects with us, but he loves the buy and hold business. And he doesn't seem to really want to be a home builder guy per se. He likes the residual, the passive nature of owning multis and things of that nature. So we're starting to ramp that up because I believe as he kind of graduates from high school, goes into college and things of that nature, that's going to pique his interest. He's going to major in finance. And so he loves that part. Nice. And so that business, I think, was going to appeal to him. You know, years right before COVID, I kind of delved into buying an RV park or a mobile home park. And I'm pretty good with finding deals. I found two really amazing deals on a mobile home park and an RV park. And as is customary with some of us, we say we want something. Then when it shows up, we get scared. And that's exactly what I did, right?
I don't think I've ever signed a closing statement without being scared. I'm scared. Every closing, I get scared.
Man, tell me about it. And so in the back of my mind, I still want to do one of those kind of one of either RV park. I've kind of settled in that I think I want an RV park. So we're going to start to play with some of those kind of concepts a little bit more over the years. And so, you know, that's pretty much what I see us doing over the next 10 years is getting a little bit deeper into apartment complexes. I always do residential just because I love it. But as I get older and probably want to stop working the way I work right now, I'm going to start doing bigger deals.
Got it. So when you got started in the business, you know, it may have come from a slightly naive place of saying like, hey, I don't want to charge top of market. I want to make sure that I, you know, have competitive rents and I can get great families in here. Over time, has that perspective evolved? And what I'm not asking the question very good, but what I'm saying is it may have come from a spot in your heart, but I think over a long enough time horizon, it's also a great business practice to make sure you always have demand and you're not absolutely chipping away at the top of market. What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, early on in my career, again, I entered real estate on the finance side, and I will never, you know, I used to tell people on the investing side, when we were buying houses, a lot of times you're buying a house because I was on the lending side, I'd buy a lot of houses out of distress. So I'm a lender. They call, they want to refinance. They can't refinance. They got a 474 credit score. They're 8 months behind, blah, 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 blah. My only option that I could give them was, hey, listen, I could get you some cash out of this house, you know, and buy it, and we'll do whatever we're going to do with it. And so I used to tell people when I buy houses, it was always a large part of it was a bad day for the person selling me the house. And so when I started to sell houses, lease them and whatnot, especially when we sell houses, I always try and sell our house. If it's worth, you know, 500, I'd like to sell it for four. If I can make money and hit our metrics at 480, 485, I want to do so, so that day one they have equity. And so that's always been one of our philosophies is to try and deliver our product to where whoever the buyer is, day one, they have equity. Now, we can't do that in 100% of the cases because there are some cases where we need every dollar that we put into this plus as much margin as we can get. And so there are certain transactions we have where we're able to kind of be a little bit more philanthropic. You know, we sold a duplex not long ago. It was worth $250,000. We sold it to a nonprofit that housed homeless people for $215,000. And what they did is closed on the house, then turned around and sold it for the
$250,000. Man, you show the incentive, people will show you the outcome.
But you know, and somebody asked me, well, how do you feel about that? Do you upset? I say, you know what? I said, hey, listen, you know, I sold it to them. So who am I to have an attachment to what they did with something once I sold it to them? Once I sold it to them, I relinquished the ability to control what transpired there. And who am I to deny them the opportunity to, you know, yeah, they're a nonprofit doing great work. Well, they probably need that 35 grand to keep on doing great work. But getting back to the crux of your question, though, is, you know, from the start, from how we started to today, you know, I think all that's happened is we can just service more people. You know what I mean? And so And I'll be honest with you, it's also helped us attract capital in from outside people who, you know, there are people that fundamentally want to help other people, or they want to do what's right. And they're looking for operators and GPs who have something outside of just making profit as their motive for doing business. And so that's also helped us be able to bring in some outside capital in certain cases, which afforded us the opportunity to service more people and provide value, whether it's, you know, offering a little bit lower than market rate rent and or selling the property and leaving a little bit of equity there.
Very good. Last big question I'll ask you. That might be a tough one, but I imagine you've been asked it before. How do you think about gentrification? How do you think about transitioning neighborhoods, right? Like, some of that stuff is very divisive in, you know, right, the wrong social setting. So how do you address those questions? How do you think through making a neighborhood better, but trying to make the people that are already there better, as opposed to just replacing those people with new people?
Yeah, 100%. You know, one, I think I see a lot of conjecture online about gentrification and whatnot. And I think, number one, gentrification has a bad PR team. You know, their PR team they just haven't done a good job of really providing education. A lot of people have comments and opinions on it, and they're just unwarranted. You know, I always tell people, especially here in America, I say, unless you've gone to a city like New York and done a historical tour, a historical real estate tour, to really understand, because that's one of the few places where I think you can study gentrification at its highest level here in America. And I've done that. And so that's the first thing I tell people is really study this, not what you think, not what the political people or the city planners in your city has to say. Like, really do an in-depth study on gentrification is point one. But for me, I'm a person that don't believe gentrification is bad. My neighborhood, again, I grew up in a place called Fifth Ward. We called it the Bloody Nickel. It was a reason why we called it the Bloody Nickel. It was a reason why, when I was growing up, the guys I looked up to that were on the corner sold drugs and had the Cadillacs and big chains like LL Cool J. And it was a reason why one day when I was about 15 or 16, I realized that as much as I loved my neighborhood, when I got married and had kids, I couldn't raise them in my neighborhood because of the environment that was there. So the question becomes, as bad as that neighborhood was, even though I loved it, but I loved it because it was my neighborhood. If I grew up in another neighborhood that was nicer, I would love it too. So the reality of the matter is we have had to do something to make that neighborhood better. Anytime better comes in today, people say, oh, that's gentrification. And they associate that as being negative. To me, the issue isn't gentrification. The issue is the people and the stakeholders that are already there either don't own and or aren't involved in a process to help better the community. And then that brings about. And what also happens is people tend to conflate gentrification with displacement. The two are not the same. Just because an area gets gentrified or redeveloped doesn't mean you have to displace everyone who's already there. So I think displacement is one thing, gentrification is another. And then the last part, which goes back to something we said earlier, there's a 6 to 8 million home shortage in America. The issue isn't gentrification. The issue is a lack of affordable housing and the system that we have that almost suppresses affordable housing. You know what I mean? Like, I'm on our panel in Houston. We have a committee called Livable Places, and we're responsible for creating the development guidelines that all builders have to subscribe to here in our city. And, you know, I'm asked to speak on different panels and things of that nature fairly regularly. Or, you know, I've worked with, you know, different I've been afforded the opportunity through Rice Kinder Institute and some other institutions to work with different senators and different people all around the country. And one of the questions I ask is, well, how can we stimulate more affordable housing? I say, easy. The first thing I'd love for you guys to do is give us expedited permitting. There's no reason why, if I'm building affordable housing, it should take me 4, 5, 6 months to get a permit, especially if it's affordable, especially if I'm selling it below the average median home price and I'm servicing the AMI that most needs it. So there are some societal issues that make it difficult for us to provide affordable housing. So getting back to your question, to me, it's one, understanding what gentrification is, which is really just making something better. And most people associate gentrification with displacement. That's totally different. You know what I mean? But that's still an issue. So I think where we have to take our focus is to increasing the amount of affordable housing. Now, that brings about a whole nother issue, because we have a labor constrained market. We could have all the permits and approvals we want, but we don't have enough plumbers. We don't have enough electricians. We don't have enough carpenters. We don't have enough framers. So there's several different levels to this thing where we got to attack this problem. It's a fairly complex issue, and there's no one solution. It's we got to attack it on all those different fronts.
I want one more point. So you used to be a mortgage broker, so I wanted your opinion on this too, because we've had tenants buy houses from us on lease options before, cheap houses, like under 160 grand. Getting lending on those things is not easy, in my experience. I haven't done it as much as you have, but it's not easy. So do you think there's a lending component to that too? Like, how do we increase the percentage of home ownership in these areas before they gentrify? It's something you kind of talked about. Is lending part of that? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, no, 100%. Lending, before you can get to lending, you got to get to financial education. And, you know, the reality of the matter is our education system doesn't do anything as it relates to really financial education. And so, you know, we have to start to kind of more educate people in some of the communities, you know, that we got to start educating those people that are below middle class to help them understand how financing works, how, you know, all home ownership works. In addition to that, you know, there is no shortage of lending programs out there. But what I found is, you know, sometimes you just don't know what you don't know. And the reality of the matter is there's no shortage of down payment assistance programs and things of that nature, but most people don't know that they're there. And then the other issue is more of a, I don't know if it's societal, but these programs, assistance programs are so difficult, right? So if you go through a down payment program, assistance program, man, it may take you 4, 5, 6 months to get through the approval process. And so it's like the infrastructure, if you will, for administering those programs is so tedious. And so I think we got to move to something within the free market where it's a little bit more competitive and a little bit more efficient to get people this assistance, because most of the governmental programs that are administering it, unfortunately, they're not efficient. It's rare that governmental entities operate in an efficient manner. So we have to come up with more free market solutions to it. And it starts with financial education. It starts with having loan products that will help people be able to afford some of these houses. I think we have to do something to kind of subsidize interest rates to a certain degree for affordable home buyers and things of that nature. So, again, it's a problem that we have to attack on multiple fronts. You know, America has to get back to producing. Everyone's not going to be, you know, go to college and get degrees and so on and so forth. You know, when I was in high school, I went to a high school that was called Barbara Jordan School for Careers. And so they taught us welding, auto mechanics, carpentry and things of that nature. Very few schools offer that. So we need to start offering career paths for people to get into the trades. And these are wonderful careers. As we're on Twitter all the time seeing guys buying different mechanical and service businesses because of how lucrative they can be. But the average high school student who has no desire to go to college has no idea that the plumber driving that F-150 down the street has, you know, two Porsches in his driveway and makes $300,000-$400,000 a year. They don't know that's the guy who's on the, you know, at the lake with the big, you know, nice boat or whatnot.
Did you tell? I dropped a check off of my plumber's house this morning. I Zillowed his house. His estimate was $1.75 million. No joke. Hey,
listen, one of my flooring guys breeds horses. And it's so funny. He has one of his horses. Now, I think he has about 10 of them. But one of his horses cost $30,000. So I'm saying, like, come on now. This is the flooring guy. You don't even need a license to do flooring. So going back to the point, though. So like all of these different modalities and different angles are things that we got to do a better job at, which will help us be able to provide more affordable housing.
Like it, man. This is a fun conversation, Tyron. Where can people find you? You know, what should people check out? How can they learn more about you, man?
Yeah. On Twitter, I'm the Urban CEO, Tyron McDaniel, at Tyron McDaniel, the Urban CEO. On Instagram, Houston Vintage Homes. Those are the two best ways to find me, where I hang out on a social media platform.
Cool. Well, we really appreciate your time. Frank, take us away, man.
This was a great episode. Thanks again, Tyron, for coming on. It was a lot of fun. See everybody next week. Peace.